Welcome to another episode of Colorado Matters at the Tattered. I'm Ryan Warner, and a live audience joins us at the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Highlands Ranch to hear about a whodunit. It's called The Unquiet Dead. But this is so much more than a whodunit. The book draws on the diverse life experience of its author, Asma Zahanat Khan. She's an international human rights lawyer who lives in Denver and now writes full-time. Her expertise, war crimes in Bosnia, where it's estimated 100,000 people, many of them Muslim, were slaughtered in the 1990s. The genocide plays a big role in this debut novel. Khan, who's Muslim herself, is formerly editor-in-chief of Muslim Girl, which she says was the first magazine for young Muslim women. And let's welcome her to our stage.
Thank you so much.
Asma, you could have written any number of books about the genocide, perhaps a more straightforward historical account, but you chose to embed this history in a detective novel. Why?
For several reasons. And it's actually interesting that you bring that up, because I first did try to write this as a straight-up history of the war in Bosnia. And I just found that I wasn't comfortable with that approach. It didn't feel as authentic to me. And there were several themes that I thought I could get to if I tried something more personal to myself that would allow me to use other characters that were constantly in my head and speaking to me, and coming at it in a way that would really wrestle with one of the central questions of the war in Bosnia, which was identity. That war was about identity. And so for me to write authentically and convincingly and get into those characters' heads, I thought I had a better entry point as a Muslim woman writing about this war.
And in the confines of a detective novel, what about that genre appeals to you?
Everything about that genre appeals to me. I've been reading mystery fiction myself probably since I was 5 years old, graduating from stage to stage, the early Enid Blyton novels, and then moving on to Agatha Christie, and then just getting my hands into at least 25 or 30 writers that I read regularly. And there is absolutely nothing that I personally love more than a puzzle. I like to figure out what's going to happen. And the kinds of puzzles that most interest me are puzzles that are centered on human motivation. Why do people do the things they do? What do they think they can gain by doing those things?
The book takes place in Toronto, where you lived for a long time. And you actually hope that this is the first of a series of books. Why don't you introduce us to your detective team? These are two very different people who are paired together.
That's right. My detectives are Inspector Isa Khatak of community policing. So he's the boss. And then he works with a sergeant who is his partner. Her name is Rachel Getty. And they come from two completely different backgrounds. And they have a very different approach to police work. But the thing that they both have in common is a strong desire for justice.
Isa Khatak, like yourself, is Muslim.
That's right.
How many Muslim characters have you run into in American mystery?
Maybe two or three, I think. There is an Elizabeth George novel that focuses on a Muslim milieu, and she has a recurring Muslim character. And a few in Deborah Crombie's mysteries I've seen as well, but not that many, certainly.
Do you feel like you're forging new ground here?
I think I am, in the sense that I'm able to get inside the head of my Muslim detective, and I've, you know, put some things in him that are specific to me, although he took on a life of his own once I started writing him. But he shares my very specific ethnic background. My parents are South Asian. They're from Pakistan. They were born in India. But we are Pathans or Pashtuns. So it's a very specific ethnicity, and it carries a lot of interesting cultural baggage with it. Those were things that I thought were really fun to put inside Isa Khatak's head that he carries with him everywhere.
And you might assume then that you feel closest or most like that character, Isa Khatak. But I understand it's actually Rachel Getty, his partner, that you identify with more.
That's true. And Rachel actually is my favorite character. I've actually now written three books that have Rachel in them. This is the first one to be published, but there was a prequel as well, and I've just finished the next one in the series. So Rachel, I love to write because she's really tough, she's really smart, she's really independent. She defies everybody's expectations of her. She's not very politically correct, but she is extremely empathetic to the people who most need empathy and compassion.
They are part of a special kind of detective team. they're not your run-of-the-mill homicide detectives.
So in this book and in this series of books, I wanted to have a lot of latitude in the kinds of cases that Issa and Rachel would investigate. So I was advised about Ontario policing, but I chose to create a unit called Community Policing Section with a very specific mandate to be called in as consultants on minority-sensitive investigations to contribute expertise in that department, but also to provide some kind of representation and sensitivity to minorities who have difficult relationships with the police. It could be the Muslim community, depending on the issue, so that they would both be able to be represented during the investigations, but also have someone who would understand what they're looking at when they investigate crimes in those communities.
So they are on sometimes very politically sensitive cases.
Yes, that's true. And that's certainly the case in this particular book, The Unquiet Dead. Issa Khatak is now inside an investigation which it looks like might relate to a Bosnian Serb war criminal. And so because of his own background and because of his particular experience, he's seen as the perfect person to get into that question.
It turns out that Issa Khatak, the lead detective, was connected to the Bosnian genocide, not as a bad actor, but as someone who is trying to bring relief.
That's right. One of the reasons that Issa is so sensitive to the issue is because he himself was part of a student activist movement. And with this particular character, I actually had him accompany a humanitarian aid mission to the city of Sarajevo during the war. So he's been in a city under siege, and he has some understanding of what that might be like.
Okay, so your detectives are asked to investigate the death of a man named Christopher Drayton. He fell from some bluffs, and it's unclear if he was pushed, jumped, or if it was just an accident. Why would this highly specialized team be called in on this seemingly mundane case? And this mystery, by the way, is like the first 20 or 30 pages of your book. You're going, why is this skilled team on this mundane murder?
So now we are getting into spoiler territory. But since the inside cover of my book actually gives this away, I don't think I'm going to do too much damage by telling you that.
Wait, was that a surprise to you that the book jacket gave away this?
When it first happened and it was discussed, I said, I took a lot of care not to reveal that for 6 chapters. And here it is. Like, as soon as you open the book, you're going to see that information. So my publishing team told me, look, we need some hook. We need some way to tell what this story is about. So that much you're going to have to give away up front. So I think I can discuss a little bit here as well. Well, they're called in because they find out that Christopher Drayton may have been a cover for another identity. So the murdered person in this book may have been a Bosnian Serb war criminal. And if he was, and he was living in Canada under this alias comfortably and safely for so many years, of course that's going to unleash this political firestorm in the country. How did he get there? Why hasn't he been apprehended? Why hasn't he been indicted? And what's he been doing in Canada all this time?
How did that idea come to you? Are there cases of Bosnian war criminals having lived comfortably somewhere abroad, or?
Not in Canada that I'm aware of. I do know that a fugitive from Rwanda, one of the leading genocidaires in the Rwandan genocide, was in Canada and was eventually apprehended there. But I really wanted an entry point into the war, and this was the best way that I could think of to humanize it from both sides.
What got you interested in the war? Are you like your character Issa Khatak in that you were interested at the time that it was going on, or...?
I think Issa Khatak is a lot braver than I am, that's certainly true. But I was a student of international law when the war began. And so immediately the subject matter that was part of my academic research became very real. And not just for me, but I think for a generation of student activists who were able to see what one of the representatives before the Security Council called a slow-motion genocide unfold before my eyes while I was a young woman. And while I always believed that I might have the capacity to do something about it, and not simply in terms of humanitarian aid, but through political activism, you never think you'll see something like that on your television screen, concentration camps, or hear about rape camps, or hear about cities being sieged and bombarded and looted and people being murdered wholesale. But when you see it, you can't just sit by. You want to do something about it. So that made my academic work certainly much more real.
Let's talk a bit more about your characters. So they realize that they're on this case that could be very sensitive. How might a war criminal have entered into Canada? How do they deal with that information, that news?
They're shocked, they're horrified, and then they have to uncover the tactics that a person would have used to come into Canada under a false identity. And actually, this was an area that was easy for me to work on because I used to practice immigration law in Canada.
Well, as they investigate the death of Christopher Drayton, who may or may not be a war criminal, they're also dealing with upset in their personal lives. Give us just a glimpse of what Issa and Rachel are struggling with personally. Because you have to make the reader like these characters, too, especially if this is a series and we're going to be with them for years to come.
Absolutely. It's very important that people like my detectives and be able to relate to them and maybe even see some of the same human qualities in themselves that the detectives possess. So Rachel, one of the reasons that Rachel is so tough is because she comes from a very dysfunctional family. Her father is a superintendent in the police. He's retired now, but he's a very aggressive man. And her situation is more precarious because he's extremely popular. He has a fantastic reputation as a police officer. He's well respected everywhere he goes, but his persona in the home is much more problematic, and it's shaped everything about Rachel's life. So that's what Rachel's carrying with her, a need to prove herself, a need to show that she can stand apart from her father and that she has her own things that she brings as a police officer. Issa, I don't reveal that much about Issa himself personally in this book as I do in the next one. Constant plugging of my next novel. But Issa has a particular relationship that I focus on, which is this lifelong friendship that he's had with a writer who writes fiction, but is also known as a public intellectual for his contribution to debates on multiculturalism in Canada. And the two men have grown up together, and they're sort of shaped by each other. And this relationship has become estranged. And that's an estrangement that Issa must tackle throughout this particular mystery as well.
Solving the mystery of this murder or this death, and solving the mystery of his friendship. This is so much to juggle in one book. Okay, so you're talking about genocide, you're talking about the murder and the case, then you're talking about the private lives of your two detectives. How do you weave that into a cohesive narrative? It's a lot to juggle.
It's a lot to juggle, but I think the books that I most like to read do that kind of exploration. They look at deeper themes. They bring their detectives alive by giving them so much backstory and history and making them real people and not just automatons who are, you know, on a crime-solving mission. Those are the kinds of books that I like to read. So when I was tackling it, what helps me is I always write a very thorough running scene outline from the beginning to the end of the book. So I know what each character has to accomplish as a person, and then what has to happen for the crime to work and the crime to be solved. And I try to keep track of all those things all the way through. And I go through many, many drafts. I make lots of mistakes. And then I get that comment saying, wait, the gun was here in chapter 4 and it's somewhere else in chapter 10. So all of that happens as well. But I think with each successive draft, you get very comfortable with where your story is going.
So in the beginning, do those plot points, do they look like a diagram or something you draw out, or are they something that you write out in words?
I write them in paragraph form. My running scene outline is usually 40 pages long before I actually start writing. And then it's constantly revised, and then my characters grow and do unexpected things, and then I have to throw it out and then just put the new changes in and remember that this has to match that at the ending of the book.
Yeah, continuity is so important. And I imagine you have in your head a really smart mystery reader who's looking to find an error, right?
Like, absolutely.
And you said the candlestick was in the living room or something.
Exactly. And I actually have read interviews with my favorite writers who say they get mail all the time pointing out the things that they've done wrong. So I was a little bit conscious of that don't make glaring, obvious errors. Don't describe the wrong kind of gun. Know what kind of ammunition might go in that gun. Little things like that. But I look, that's part of the puzzle that is intriguing and fulfilling for me. So I try to get it right, but I'm open to getting those letters if I get it wrong.
That sounds terrifying, not gratifying to me.
This is Colorado Matters at the Tattered. I'm Ryan Warner, and you're hearing a conversation with Denver mystery writer Asma Zahanit Khan, recorded at the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Highlands Ranch. Khan's new novel is called The Unquiet Dead. When we come back, the stirring words that start each of her chapters, they're excerpts from war crimes testimony. Plus, Khan talks about the joy she derives from rereading her favorite books. This is Colorado Public Radio. It's Colorado Matters from CPR News. I'm Ryan Warner. We're back at the Tattered Cover Bookstore, this time in Highlands Ranch, to meet Denver human rights attorney and mystery writer Asma Zahanit Khan. Her debut novel is called The Unquiet Dead. She blends a traditional whodunit with her expertise on war crimes in the Balkans, namely the massacre at Srebrenica in 1995.
Each chapter starts with a few lines in italics, phrases that really knock the wind out of you. One example from the start of a chapter. I took my mother's head into my hands and I kissed her. I never felt anything so cold before. Where does that come from?
The phrases that I use in italics at the beginning of each chapter are almost all of them are quotations from actual war crimes testimony. So they are primarily from Bosnian witnesses or victims of the war. Occasionally they are from Croatians as well. And what I was trying to do, and this was really important to me, this was probably the single most important thing in writing this book, was to try to represent as many unheard, authentic Bosnian voices as I possibly could in this book.
And in a way, it's a reset. So you finish a chapter, which may have delved into the personal lives of your detectives. You start the next chapter, and you're reminded, this is what this book is about at its heart. Do you think that's true? Is that a proper interpretation of your intention?
I think that's exactly right. It's exactly what I was aiming for. And I went through hundreds and hundreds of these quotations, choosing the ones that I would use. And I would try to find the ones that best represent what happened to the Bosnians, but also what best reflects the themes of the book and the themes of what my characters are having happen to them in those particular chapters. I was always trying to make those kinds of connections.
I see. So the genocide, the strife, in some way as a metaphor as well for what your characters were going through.
Because one of the things that the characters frequently deal with in the book is the theme of estrangement or the theme of injustice. And that can apply to them at a very personal level, as well as at this broader level of looking at a war.
This is what I love about talking to an author after I've read the book, is you just broke something open for me that I didn't necessarily pick up. It's subtle. It's subtle, and now I have goosebumps because it's so profound.
Thank you.
No. Does that worry you that readers won't pick up on something you're trying to do quite intentionally?
It doesn't worry me. I think because I read so much myself, and then I reread a lot of books that I like, and I always gain something from each new reading of a book. So I think that people will bring their own experiences and preconceived notions and assumptions and reading of the world to my book, and that's fine, as long as something of it penetrates.
You think books are meant to be reread, it sounds like.
I do. I know I reread the books that I love again and again. There's a book called Samarkand by Amin Maalouf that I read, you know, every 2-3 years. I read the book Dune by Frank Herbert every single year since I was 13.
Dune, which became a movie, of course.
Yes, it did, and a miniseries too. Yes, it's actually probably my favorite book that's ever been written that I've ever read. I love it. I read it first when I was 13 and every year again since then.
Wow. And you get something different out of it every time.
I do. And I just love the characters, and I think it has a lot to teach me about writing well, how to construct a scene with multiple characters, which is a really difficult thing to do. Not to only be in one person's head, but to have 15 people at a dinner table and try to represent what's happening, what's the action, what's the dynamism. And that's something I think I learned really well from reading Dune, because it happens continually in scenes that the author constructed.
Well, we're interested in what books you have reread and perhaps reread multiple times at our Facebook page, CPR News. You can tell us what book qualifies for you. There are several chapters where you leave the story of the investigation entirely, flashbacks to the massacre at Srebrenica. One is an account of Bosnian Muslims who found temporary safety on a UN base and then are forced to leave by Dutch troops. And they know that leaving this base is going to be the end of them. This chapter is terrifying, it's powerful. Did it really happen?
Yes, it absolutely did happen. That was the prelude to the massacre at Srebrenica. And what happened was the Serb assault on the safe area Srebrenica had begun. And so the people of the entire Srebrenica enclave started to gather at the UN base because they thought that base would be their safety. So in the beginning, 15,000 people, then 20,000, then 30,000 people crowding into this base, desperate for United Nations protection. And the force on the ground was called the United Nations Protection Force, although, of course, it was not in any way equipped to defend any one of those 6 safe areas, let alone Srebrenica. So they said, this is UN property. We cannot possibly keep you here. We cannot accommodate you here. You're going to be seen as provocation to the Serb army if we keep you here. So anyone who's here is going to have to leave, and the only people who can stay are those who are the Bosnian negotiators or those who directly work for the UN.
And that was a small fraction of the people gathered there.
That's correct, a very small fraction.
It's so strange that you referred to safe areas of Srebrenica under attack by the Serbs. Safe areas is a relative term in a war zone.
It was a creation of the United Nations, this concept that, well, there's a war going on here. We have a huge peacekeeping force on the ground, although there is no peace to keep. There is no possible way of keeping a peace. So there shouldn't be UN peacekeepers in a war zone. But what we're going to do instead, we're going to look at the areas that are most vulnerable to the attack of the Bosnian Serb army, and we're going to designate them as United Nations safe areas. And they were these six major towns and the surrounding villages of those towns that were supposed to be free of shelling and bombardment. But in fact, the reality of the war is those safe areas and many other of the towns and villages in Bosnia were repeatedly bombarded, shelled. Their water supplies were cut. Their electricity supplies were cut. Food couldn't go in or out except whatever the Bosnian Serb army would allow to go through UN convoys. So it was a very drastic and dire situation. The nation was under siege.
In this book, you indict, or your characters indict, Western nations for having allowed the Bosnian genocide to occur. And in fact, the UN later acknowledged that that was the case. Would you read just a small snippet from the UN's findings after a review?
Absolutely. So this paragraph is from the UN report on the fall of Srebrenica. This report was published in 1999. What it says is, "It is with the deepest regret and remorse that we have reviewed our actions and decisions in the face of the assault on Srebrenica. Through error, misjudgment, and an inability to recognize the scope of the evil confronting us, we failed to do our part to help save the people of Srebrenica from the Serb campaign of mass murder. The tragedy of Srebrenica will haunt our history forever."
The tragedy of Srebrenica will haunt our history forever. Those are strong words coming from the UN, really looking at its own actions.
They're a very strong, I think, indictment, a very strong condemnation. But I think the really sad reality of it is they're just words on paper. It really hasn't changed international politics in any way, because at the beginning of the war in Syria, we could see a very similar situation between what was happening in Bosnia to what happened in Syria. So if the lessons of Bosnia had been learned, that a small action taken early can prevent tremendous loss of life, it can prevent all the horrors that accompanied the war, because some people would argue there are worse things than simply dying. There's having to live in a rape camp for months. There's having to be in a concentration camp and be tortured and beaten daily. So a small action taken early on does not require a massive United Nations presence on the ground for 3 years. And I don't think that lesson was learned. I don't think we've seen it anywhere.
Do you want readers of this mystery book to pick up on this, to be challenged with this idea?
I think that's a really good question, because, I mean, my area of specialization in international law was military intervention for human protection purposes. And I think it's hard to find a more divisive issue in international law or international politics. Is military intervention for human protection purposes, is that something that is just another form of imperialism or colonization or interference?
Invasion.
Invasion or occupation in countries that have already had a long history of these things? Or is it really necessary as a human rights or moral imperative? And I think, you know, people will come down on both sides of that issue. But I would be surprised if you could walk away from The Unquiet Dead, at least not considering what we're prepared to do for the needs of others.
We're talking about the new novel from Denver mystery writer Asma Zahanid Khan. She joined us in front of a live audience at the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Highlands Ranch. After a break, a plot twist that at first threw me as a reader, then gradually sunk in and struck me as really profound. This is Colorado Matters from CPR News. You're back with Colorado Matters at the Tattered. I'm Ryan Warner. Once a month, we take the show on the road to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and sit down with an author. At the Highlands Ranch store, we met Denver mystery writer Asma Zahanid Khan. Her new novel is called The Unquiet Dead. Khan is an attorney with a background in international human rights law who now writes full time.
The man whose death is being investigated in your book, again, who may or may not be a war criminal, planned to give a substantial sum of money to a new museum, one that focused on the history and culture of Andalusia in southern Spain. And when readers first encounter this plot twist, it might seem mystifying. And in fact, it's mystifying to one of the detectives, Rachel, who at first can't possibly see the connection between this region in Spain and the genocide in Bosnia. What does Andalusia represent to you? Why include it in the book?
That's a great question. I'm so glad you asked me that question. To me, Andalusia represents, I think, one of the dazzling moments of human civilization, and I think the values that a lot of us hold in common, which is pluralism, multiculturalism, by incorporating values and knowledge and languages and culture, and in the case of Andalusia, this very specific cultural product called the ring song, which was a wonderfully expressive way of using language, either Arabic or Hebrew or the Romance language of the time, to proliferate either ideas about love or God or religion. But what Andalusia really represents to me is the idea that people of different faiths can live together peaceably, respecting each other, learning from each other, with nobody trying to have the upper hand. And a lot of the research that I did on Bosnia before the war, a lot of the historians and commentators would say that Bosnia was a second Andalusia because its people did live together peacefully.
And give us a sense of the time here. So when did Andalusia represent this beacon of cooperation?
So it began in the 700s, and it's often also referred to as the Moorish occupation of Spain, but it was a period that stretched for 900 years.
And what broke up the peace in Andalusia?
All kinds of things, and this is something that the book gets into. And it's not the kinds of things that we might expect, that Jews are going to war with Christians or Christians are going to war with Muslims. What was so interesting about Andalusia was that there were all kinds of alliances between these communities and indeed between many other communities. So you could have Christians and Muslims allied together for a particular political reason in a particular, what was called a taifa, like a small town or city, and they could be together fighting a different Muslim force. So these allegiances wouldn't necessarily break down on faith lines. And that's one of the things that I find interesting about it, that we assume that we're all going to retreat to our flag or our faith or our tribe, but civilization can always surprise you.
And to this term ring song, let's just spend a little bit more time there. In reading the book, my sense is that ring song is almost a form of poetry.
That's correct. The ring song was poetry. And actually the museum that you refer to in the book is called Ring Song. And it was one of the imprimaturs of Andalusian civilization. So if you wanted to show that you were cultured and sophisticated and tolerant and talented, you would produce these ring songs. You would write poetry. And initially, it was all about love. It was all about the beloved. So it might be hard to imagine a Muslim civilization where all the poets are obsessing about how gorgeous and, you know, how the women are so incredible that they have to write line after line about how intoxicating they are. But that's, in fact, what this first cycle of ring songs is all about. And then that same idea of intoxication gets translated over to the divine being. So just as a woman can be intoxicating, and anyone who's familiar with Rumi's poetry, which is not ring songs, but knows that he always writes about the divine as an intoxicating force. To me, that's really intriguing and magical and unexpected, and I like things that surprise me.
There is ring song in the book.
That's right.
Will you read some of it for us?
Yes. I addressed one of the wing-born singers, who was sad at heart and a quiver. For what do you lament so plaintively, I asked. And it answered, for an age that is gone forever.
Like the age of Andalusia.
Like the age of Andalusia and like Bosnia before the war.
And here it turns out that the man who is at the center of the mystery here, who is dead, we don't know if he's been murdered or committed suicide, and he may or may not be a war criminal. Here he is giving to a museum that supports this idea of a multicultural place, Andalusia. I guess with the idea of redeeming himself, potentially?
Well, that's a question that I raise in the book, is why would someone like Christopher Drayton, if he was this war criminal named Dražen Krstić, What possible reason could he have for identifying with the museum that celebrates the pluralism of Andalusia? And this is actually a question that my editor asked me repeatedly, saying it doesn't make sense. But I think what you get to in the book in the end is there is...
You don't have to answer it here.
I probably shouldn't, because it's a spoiler of tremendous proportions.
That's it. The audience is shushing us.
All right.
Let's talk about your time as editor-in-chief of Muslim Girl magazine. It was primarily directed at young women in the United States and some in Canada. What were you trying to accomplish with it?
So many different things. I was with the magazine for 3 years, and it was definitely the most exciting period of my life. But what we wanted to do, the motto of the magazine was enlighten, celebrate, inspire. And what we were really looking to achieve was to provide a counter-narrative about Muslim identity in the West, which I know sounds very heavy, especially when our magazine doesn't look that different from 17. Or Teen Vogue, actually. But what we were looking for is to show that the lived realities of young Muslim women in the West are so different from the common public perception of them. And we wanted to represent a broad spectrum of different kinds of girls, of the different values that they may have had, but more importantly, what's the contribution that they're making to society, things that you don't expect of them. So we would do lots of stories on sports or fashion. We did a story on a Canadian Muslim girl who joined the Canadian Army. We wanted to tweak the notion that a Muslim woman or a Muslim girl is a subjugated person, a person who doesn't have agency or a voice of her own. And I think by showing very authentic stories about real girls, and every one of our covers featured a real Muslim girl from either Canada or the U.S., I think that we were somewhat successful in doing that.
In your new book, one character talks about her struggle with whether to wear a headscarf, and it made me wonder if that was a topic you took on in the magazine.
The headscarf, my least favorite subject of discussion, but I know that it is a question that intrigues a lot of people, so I will address it. But yes, when we first put the magazine out, I have to say that was a subject that was on everybody's minds constantly, because what our magazine, in showing all these different Muslim girls, is showing girls with headscarves and without headscarves, and it really seemed a matter of obsession. And it's not just an obsession for our communities in the West, and it's just not just an obsession for Westerners looking at Muslim women. It's an obsession in Muslim lands where the issue is always being legislated one way or the other. We want scarves on your head, or we don't want to let you wear scarves. And this kind of obsession to me is incredibly frustrating, because what it's really saying is what's on your head is so much more important than what's in your head. And with the magazine, we dealt with that question up front. We tackled it because our readers wanted us to tackle it. But then we just said, okay, that's one aspect of Muslim identity. It's personal between a girl and her creator, what she chooses to do in this respect. But we're actually interested in everything else you have to contribute. What are your ideas? What's your intellect? What's your creativity? What are your thoughts about your own identity? What contribution do you want to make in the world? So I didn't want the magazine to get derailed on that subject that is such a preoccupation for so many people. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask if you struggled with the question yourself, but you said it's about the relationship between a Muslim woman and her God. It doesn't feel like my business as a result. Thank you for setting the boundary.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it.
More of our conversation with Denver author Asma Khan after a break. Her new thriller is called The Unquiet Dead. Coming up, she reflects on Islamic extremism, American support for Saudi Arabia, and the writing contest she lost, which changed her life. This is Colorado Matters at the Tattered from CPR News. It's Colorado Matters from CPR News. I'm Ryan Warner. Let's pick up our conversation with Denver mystery writer Asma Zahanat Khan. Her new novel is called The Unquiet Dead. She grew up in Canada and sets this new book there. Before the break, we talked about Khan's faith and her time at Muslim Girl magazine. Now let's get to some current events.
Why don't we reflect just a bit on the attacks in Paris? This was, of course, by Islamic extremists, and they were reacting in part to depictions of the Prophet Muhammad in a satirical newspaper. And I'm curious about your thoughts as a Muslim, but really as a journalist and a writer. What's been your reaction?
Well, my primary reaction, I think, is the same reaction that everybody has. The attacks were horrific. I unequivocally and categorically condemn them. They do not represent any variant of faith that I am familiar with or that the majority of my co-religionists are familiar with. As someone who has done journalism in the form of Muslim Girl magazine, of course I promote and respect the right to freedom of speech. And I think that much more harm, if you look at it from the perspective of these extremists, much more harm is done to the image of the prophet they claim to represent or the religion they claim to practice by an act of violence such as taking an innocent life than could ever be done by a cartoon. And I don't think that Islam, for those who believe in it, or the prophet of Islam, are such weak and transitory things that they can be crippled or harmed in any way by these depictions. So I think it's a completely misguided message. But I do also want to clarify that those types of actions, that type of extremist violence that we see in the world, is certainly a very limited minority interpretation of the faith. And I think it has been roundly condemned by all Muslim organizations and certainly all the Muslim individuals that I know. And I think it's important to make that distinction, because otherwise Muslim communities in the West feel pressured on both sides, in the sense that these lunatics are committing these terrible acts in the name of Islam, and that's getting sort of popularized as a general conception of the faith and its practitioners. And then, of course, we get the blowback in the form of that assumption and then the prejudices or the intolerance that might result from it.
You talk about this being a minority viewpoint, for sure, but the acts are so visible. And I think also to Boko Haram and the kidnapping of the girls and the recent terrible massacre at the hands of Boko Haram. There's the high-profile lashings in Saudi Arabia that I think it's a blogger is getting.
That's right. He's been sentenced to 1,000 lashes.
1,000 lashes to be meted out over the course, I think, of several...
50 at a time.
Yeah. How do you, you know, for the audience that's reading this online and, you know, seeing it in the media, what do you say to them about separating that from their understanding of the Muslim faith? And I would say that most people would probably understand that's not the majority of Muslims, and yet it's such a visible part.
It's a visible part. These images are graphic. They are striking. I think if you want to go to that deeper level of analysis, there are so many things to say. One of the things that I'm really interested in when these issues come up, beyond the horror of them, is that what we're really looking at is these civilizational intersections, where we are looking at an act or an incident outside of its context. And it's necessary and right to immediately condemn the act and to distance yourself from it and to reject it in every possible way. But after that, what do you do? After the condemnation, after the rejection, then what happens? What comes next?
Yeah, good question.
So I think to tackle that in a way that can in any way improve the world, it means you have to understand the historical context. Where have these civilizations intersected? At what points? What legacy has that left? So not in any way to attempt any kind of justification, but I don't think you can make sense of the world. I don't think you can make sense of Syria and ISIS without first looking at the invasion and occupation of Iraq and what that produced in terms of destabilizing that society. I don't think you can make sense of what happened in Paris without looking at the French encounter with North Africa, or, for example, the French occupation of Algeria and the War of Independence and Liberation there, which a lot of people probably don't know. There's more than 1 million Algerian dead as a consequence of that war. So not that those actions or that history in any way justifies these acts in the present, but they can't be divorced from them either. So I think what I would say is we need a fuller reading of history. And then the other thing that we need to understand, I actually read a great article about this the other day by Shayla Ben-Habib, that this is a moment of civilizational despair for the Muslim world. So the Muslim world is comprised of a bunch of societies that have incredibly high illiteracy rates, poverty rates, state breakdowns, state failure.
Unemployment rates are high.
Unemployment rates. And then, of course, a lot of these Muslim nations are autocracies and tyrannies with complete repression of freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. A lot of them are torture states, Egypt, Syria. So when you look at that entire picture of civilizational despair, it's not surprising to me that you will see these elements. But I think what's also disconnected from a lot of the discussion is that the type of Islam that is most clearly linked to that comes out of Saudi Arabia, which, of course, is a friend of the United States. That incredibly intolerant, conservative, puritanical ideology is promoted through petrodollars all around the Muslim world. And that's where you get it from. Most Muslims don't want anything to do with it. I certainly would never want to live under any of those regimes. And I think most Muslims would not, but there is a context.
So you don't have anything to say on that?
I always have too much to say, but let me clarify that I am in no way an expert on any of these issues.
So here you are, a liberated Muslim woman in the West. You're writing about honor killings and terrorist cells and genocide. Do you ever fear being targeted in some way or being seen as unacceptable in the eyes of very conservative Muslims?
I don't think I'm that important, really. I don't have that kind of a profile, and I'm not afraid.
Yet, maybe.
I'm not afraid of it in any way. I think, you know, I'm a practicing Muslim woman, so one of the injunctions in the Quran is speak up against injustice wherever it occurs, even against yourselves. But what I think is different is, think about it, how many hundreds of books are written, thrillers about terrorism and Muslim terrorists and this, that, and the other. But here is someone who is now going to write from inside a Muslim's head and tell you what, you know, we actually think about these things, how we approach them, how they intersect with our own personal lives, what impact they have on us. And I think in fiction you want to do something that's original and daring and creative. And maybe you'll be good at it, maybe you won't, but that's what I'm going to try to do.
Why don't we leave on a very happy note, and that is the story of how you got your publishing deal. You lost a contest and actually won in the end.
I did.
Yeah. What's the story?
Well, to me, this feels like my own personal fairy tale, where this particular book, The Unquiet Dead, I had, in a last act of desperation before I went back to seeking full-time employment, I had entered it into two mystery contests, one in Canada where I didn't get longlisted, shortlisted, or anything else, and then one here in America with Minotaur Books, their first crime novel competition. And I'd sent the manuscript in, and of course I didn't hear anything for weeks, and then weeks turned into months, and I'd basically just given up and moved on to the next book in my head. And then I got a call out of the blue one day from an editor at Minotaur Books saying, listen, you didn't win because there were some problems with this manuscript, but I also see a lot of potential and I think we can work together well. And then she said, are you willing to make some changes to the manuscript? And I said, okay, yeah, sure. I mean, anything to get a publishing deal. And then I got an email which had, I think, at least 20, 30 pages of notes on all the things that were wrong and needed to be fixed.
Oh.
So then I took, but it was such great, productive, constructive, creative, and thrilling advice. So I took those notes and I spent a couple of months working my way through them, sent another draft, and then was on tenterhooks for several weeks until I got the call saying, hey, you know what, we're going to take this book now. So that was really wonderful for me in every possible way.
Losing was winning.
Losing was winning. That's a good way to put it.
You're listening to Colorado Matters at the Tattered. I'm Ryan Warner. And now let's hear some questions from our audience at the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Highlands Ranch.
I'm Gary Hauser from Centennial. Winston Churchill was once asked, how do you think you'll be treated by history? And he said, I think it will treat me very well because I intend to write it. So how did you treat the Bosnian War? And how will other historians view you in your treatment of that war?
That's a great question. I try to treat the war with as much authenticity as possible. And, you know, my PhD dissertation was on the fall of Srebrenica, so I had access to a lot of material that I relied upon very heavily. Wherever I wrote about the war, I tried to use as much eyewitness testimony as possible. But I know that genocides and wars are contentious, and the history of those things are very contentious. And, I mean, there are people to this day who deny that a genocide took place in Bosnia. So, you know, I think that quite possibly there will be people who take issue with how I've depicted the war. But what I really wanted to show was that here was a country where people of different faiths, the Orthodox Church, the Catholic Church, Jews, Muslims, had lived together peacefully for centuries with the small interruptions of history and had carved out this multi-ethnic, multi-religious identity that really was a thing of beauty. And in the face of ultranationalism, it was destroyed. And I think that's a terrible loss. And if people just come away from my book looking at that as a terrible loss, that's all I need, really.
Hi, I'm Patricia Jackson from Centennial, and I have more of a comment than a question for you. As Ryan so eloquently addressed, we're all being bombarded by such dark acts in the name of Islam, and I just want to thank you for offering such an articulate, intelligent, and compassionate voice to Islam. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That's very kind.
Denver author Asma Zahanit Khan. Her new novel is called The Unquiet Dead. We spoke in front of a live audience, and we invite you to join us for the next taping of Colorado Matters at the Tattered. On Monday, February 9th, we'll meet Amy Purdy, adaptive snowboarder and performer on Dancing with the Stars. She lost both of her legs to a blood infection. Purdy lives in Frisco, and her new book is On My Own Two Feet, From Losing My Legs to Learning the Dance of Life. So be there at the Colfax location, 7 p.m. on February 9th.